Last week, at the opening of the National 9/11 Museum in New York, President Obama described the U.S. this way.
A nation that stands tall and united and unafraid, because no act of terror can match the strength or the character of our country.
And in a speech last year, the president talked about the U.S. coming to a crossroads on terrorism, no longer fighting what was once called the global war on terrorism. But what exactly is the U.S. doing? Well, the cover story in this week's National Journal gives us some insight. It's titled Inside America's Shadow War on Terror and Why It Will Never End. It's a rare look at how U.S. secret forces are shaping the new battlefield. It starts with a description of two raids by elite teams hours apart on the same day last October. In Libya, one netted Anas al-Libi, who helped plot the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings in Africa. Another in Somalia targeted the al-Shabaab mastermind of the Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi. And both raids involved cooperation across U.S. agencies. James Kitfield is a contributing editor at the National Journal. He joins us from Houston. James, welcome.
Good to be here.
Well, and to further describe this shadow war, I mean, it's quite something to read. It's special ops, it's military teams, it's the FBI, up to 100 special teams traveling the world, up from 26 teams years ago. It's the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. You write one story about them tracking methamphetamines that are sold in California to support suicide bombers in Afghanistan. Flesh it out a little bit more, this shadow war.
Well, I think the model that you described, this multi-agency task forces, was really sort of pioneered and revolutionized in Afghanistan and Iraq over the last 10 years. And for all of the agencies involved, it's been a real takeaway of how you operate against this kind of a networked enemy, as I describe in the story, in the recent takedown of terrorist suspects from al-Shabaab in Somalia and al-Libi, who was captured in Libya. So there's this model of operations. It's very joint. It's very multi-agency. And it's basically, you've seen them break down the boundaries that once separated intelligence community, special operations forces, and law enforcement. To the degree to which those two raids I just talked about, there were FBI agents involved alongside SEAL Team 6 in Somalia and Delta Force in Libya. So it's a very effective model of operations. It goes back to one of its pioneers, General Stanley McChrystal, who said it takes a network to defeat a network, and it's in use all around the world.
You mentioned McChrystal coming up with this idea of counterterrorism operations, and the phrase F3EA, find, fix, finish, exploit, and analyze?
Right. You know, as they started out, the insurgents and the terrorists were basically running circles around them because they could never get a bead on who these guys were, and they were getting hit from so many different directions that it became sort of overwhelming to not only, you know, our counterterrorism guys, but our military in general. So what they started building on was this ability to, once you fall in on a target house and you arrest someone or in a case of a lethal strike, kill them, to exploit all the intelligence that resides in that house using techniques that the FBI actually bought to the Joint Special Operations Command, the same techniques they use in executing a search warrant. So you know what cell phone caught in which room belonged to which individual, and you use all that information, not only in your interrogation of the people you capture, but also in turning around the intelligence for future raids. And they built this incredible databases built on those techniques where they could increase the amount of actual intelligence that allowed them then to increase the number of these raids, whereas they started out launching maybe 5 to 10 raids a month, they were up to 200 plus by the end of this Afghan war.
Which is why, as you explained, they were almost immediately at that horrible attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. You write about FBI agents, over 80 of them, led by a special agent with these rapid deployment fly teams on the scene, even as there was still gunfire. Why? What would they do there?
Well, they did all the forensic evidence that you would hope the FBI did, for instance, after the Boston Marathon bombing, where they, cordoned off those streets and basically went down there with a fine-tooth comb and found every little bit of intelligence. And in this case, within 2 weeks, where they launched both those attacks, which is pretty quick work when you consider that they, it was only 2 weeks and it's a country that we're not at war with and it's very remote.
In the second attack, al-Libi was snatched from a street in a mission that took less than a minute and put aboard a ship floating off the coast. Tell us more about that raid and the questions that it raises about endgame when you have these special forces snatching people off the streets.
I mean, it's an interesting question because this kind of counterterrorism model very much relies on military authorities and wartime authorities. And I see no possibility of them having, you know, give up those wartime authorities. When al-Libi, who's a member of al-Qaeda and already under indictment for the 1998 embassy bombings in Africa, when they got a bead on him, they snatched him, they put him on a U.S. warship in international water, so he's not, you know, under the legal jurisdiction of any country. And they interrogated him at length with these high-value interrogation groups, which are also, again, multi-agency, intelligence, FBI, law enforcement. And then when that interrogation was finished, he's read his Miranda rights by the FBI guy, and at that moment, he's accorded all the rights of any terrorist suspect in federal jurisdiction. So he was flown at that point to New York, where he was soon in front of a federal judge.
So it's treating people like al-Libi like criminals.
When he's being interrogated by that high-value interrogation team, he's being treated as an enemy combatant. But as soon as you read him his Miranda rights, at that moment in time, he becomes a criminal suspect. So it's a conflation of wartime authorities and law enforcement authorities, and they pick and choose from the toolbox depending on, you know, when they decide they've had, you know, enough intelligence from this guy to read him his Miranda rights and then indict him in a federal court.
That's the National Journal contributing editor James Kitfield. On this week's cover story, they're calling the shadow war on terrorism the U.S. is now conducting. The usually shadowy CIA is making headlines today for saying it will no longer conduct vaccination campaigns as a cover for spy operations. You might remember the CIA enlisted a doctor to try and get into Osama bin Laden's compound under the pretense of giving shots before a special forces team did get in and killed the al-Qaeda leader. The doctor's role drew widespread criticism. But as we've been hearing, the special forces teams are very much in play, and increasingly they're joined by FBI and CIA agents. National Journal contributing editor James Kitfield wrote this week's cover story about the new U.S. playbook on terrorism. Multi-agency teams, in one case, Drug Enforcement Administration agents tracing drugs from Afghanistan to California, where they're sold to fund suicide bombers. The teams cross borders, they snatch suspects, they interrogate them as enemy combatants, and then read them their rights, at which time they've become criminal defendants. A conflation of law enforcement and the military, according to James Kitfield. And James, you quote people who back this new approach, who say if the many al-Qaeda splinter groups ever unite, it'll be worse than bin Laden's al-Qaeda ever was. But what are the critics saying?
Critics are worried about this continued conflation of military authorities and law enforcement and criminal authorities. You know, the longer that goes on, I think certainly civil libertarians have many concerns that you'll just continually to erode civil liberties. The problem is coming up with an alternative, because if you go back to treating these things just as a criminal matter, you can't go ahead and get these guys in places like Somalia or Yemen, or because they're out of your reach. You have no jurisdiction to do anything in those countries. We are able to operate in many of those countries with those countries' approval generally, but we're operating generally under wartime authorities. That's why special operations can get involved in that. So it should be noted that I think 16 Americans died of terrorism last year. So it's, you know, each one of those is a tragedy, but that's a whole lot more people than that die of gun violence in this country alone. So you would like to get to a new normal, but I can't see that new normal sort of stopping this conflation of military and law enforcement authorities in this counterterrorism model I described, because it actually works.
Well, and we were reminded of it again when we spoke with a former FBI negotiator recently, talking about what might be going on in Nigeria, where those kidnapped young girls are. And he reminded us of just how often FBI agents are traveling around the world, working alongside the military, doing investigations to help the military, again, track where these terrorist groups might be, but also to build cases. You know, this idea that, as you said, it's a conflation of military mission and bloodhound investigation.
Right. And I mean, that is the essential power of this model. And there are many other agencies who are involved in these joint terrorism task forces, including Treasury, which has gotten quite expert at tracking money flows and denying money flows to some of these more established terrorist groups. You know, the DEA has some pretty dramatic capture of drug cartel guys in Africa whose money were going to some of the terrorist groups there. And they operate with the logistic support of Africa Command, so the military support. So there is, like I said, this model of joint interagency sort of task forces using the capabilities of all these guys. And, we've got a whole generation of operators now over the last 10 years who've grown up with this model, and they've gotten quite good at it, and they don't want to go back to a situation where it's one agency against the bad guys, because not any one of those agencies can really win this fight.
You talk about the National Counterterrorism Center in Tyson's Corner. That's a suburb of Washington in Virginia, a building, Liberty One, nondescript, gray stone, but one of the most wired buildings in the world. And these 20 intelligence, national security, and law enforcement agencies have representatives inside sifting through everything.
Right. I mean, if you want to think about our counterterrorism architecture, and it does span the globe, and it's hundreds of thousands of analysts and operators and private contractors as well, that sits at the very top of that architecture as this sort of central clearinghouse. And that was a direct outflow of the 911 commission, which said that, you know, the FBI and the CIA failed to connect the dots on 9/11 in a way that they could have if they had been cooperating. So it's not to say they'll never miss the dots again, because it's a huge amount of information they have to contend with each day. But they are a place where all the information does get funneled. And so the best possibility of connecting the dots is at the NCTC.
Yeah. Well, what about the fact that it's so secretive? When Americans found out about the NSA listening in on their phone calls, there was an uproar. This is some of the same technique, but just in other countries.
That's exactly right, and it is kind of stunning at how much goes on behind the scenes. Everyone focuses on the Predator drone strike that kills, you know, a suspected terrorist in Pakistan or Yemen. But beneath that one strike, there is an iceberg of intelligence, law enforcement, and military analysts, operators that are working largely in secret. Part of that is the nature of the business. The people you're tracking don't wear uniforms. They're hiding in the shadows themselves, so you're tracking them in the shadows. But, I think the discomfort that a lot of people in this country feel about the whole counterterrorism evolution is that so much of it is in secret. And I think the Obama administration's trying to, bring some more transparency. You've seen it in the post-Snowden world with, the Director of National Intelligence coming out and being a little bit more transparent about the things they're doing. But it is quite remarkable that how much goes on with almost no commentary about it. Until, again, one of these high-profile cases, like where we killed an American citizen, Anwar Awlaki, in Yemen. This stuff goes on pretty routinely, month in, month out, week in, week out, and doesn't get a whole lot of attention because it's not that much of it is visible.
So maybe Americans accept that this is one of the only ways to counter that, secrecy with secrecy. And also, maybe it's that Americans would trade drones and FBI agents overseas for troops on the ground.
Oh, I think that's right. And I think, I think that there is a sense that as bad as things have been in the last decade, we've not seen another 9/11-like spectacular. The Boston Marathon was the first terrorist spectacular we've seen in quite some time. And that was two lone wolves who weren't really tied to any particular organization. So they're very hard to get on your radar. But if you're going to go after the people who want to do you harm, this is kind of the model that we are going to default to, and it is a lot more elegant than invading a country, I'll say that, having witnessed that twice, and basically empower other countries. And you're seeing that in Nigeria with Boko Haram. You're seeing it in Somalia, where we are empowering that African Union force that has really taken the fight to al-Shabaab. They want to use our advanced counterterrorism capabilities that we've talked about in this show, but use that to empower other actors on the ground. So your footprint's very small and very much in the shadows, while others take the lead.
Yeah. By the way, how do the drugs make their way from Afghanistan to California and then back again to fund suicide bombs?
Well, I mean, Afghanistan has many rat trails all the way from across Iran into Europe, and they also can go from Africa. There's a well-established smuggling routes all through West Africa to South America, and then up from South America, as we've seen with the Colombian and the Mexican drugs, into Washington. So there's any number of smuggling routes that can be used to get contraband to the United States from Afghanistan.
James Kitfield, contributing editor at the National Journal, will link you to his writing at hearnow.org. Thanks so much.
Happy to do it.